Hello and a very warm welcome to Bruegel's podcast, The Sound of Economics. My name is Gunther Wolf and I'm the director of Bruegel. And today I'm very pleased to host Bernd Lange, a member of the European Parliament from the Social Democratic Party from Germany. But most importantly in this context, he is also the chair of the Trade Committee of the European Parliament and therefore very deeply involved in the setting of Europe's trade policy. And I'm also happy to host my colleague, Alicia Garcia Herrero, a very esteemed colleague working on many issues, but a lot, of course, on China and on trade policy. And I want to hear also Alicia's perspective from Asia and on the Chinese policies. We want to talk today about Europe's trade policy, and we want to understand where we are, what's next, what are the big strategic questions on our minds. What are the trade-offs that we need to discuss? And I'm really grateful to you and for joining us today. So thanks for joining.
It's a pleasure, as always.
So I think we basically thought to discuss three, four big issues. I think the first is obviously the US. The second is China. And then we want to discuss more broadly, you know, what can trade policy achieve in climate, human rights and other issues. So let's start with your view on European US trade relations, but also your view, if you can, on where you see the US trade policy go at this stage. We've seen the USTR, Catherine Tai, delivering a speech a few days ago on the U.S. trade strategy. And it sounded very cautious and, you know, not very ambitious, if I can say so. And of course, the U.S. tariffs on many European products, such as steel, remain there despite the change in president. So where do you see our relation, Bernd?
Of course, the relations with the United States are really important globally, but also economically in our trade balance. We have a change with the Biden administration, no doubt about. The big change is that we are now trying to de-escalate our conflicts, our irritations, and we succeeded to have a ceasefire on the Airbus-Boeing conflict on subsidies for these aircraft companies. But of course, I always mentioned that this new Biden administration and the time after coming into force was a little bit the honeymoon of our relation. And now, as like in a normal relationship, the honeymoon is over. And now we are discussing where the sofa should be placed in the flat and which color the sofa should have. So this might lead to some conflicts also in a normal relationship. And this is the case now in our talks with the United States. We have established a Trade and Technology Council, a platform to discuss. That's also quite a positive element in our relations, so that we have really established continuous dialogue platform. But of course, Guntram, as you mentioned, there are still some irritation in the air. And one of the crucial ones is the question of illegal steel tariffs on European products, and we established countervailing measures, and we gave an extra grace period to the end of November, not doubling our countervailing measures. And now the clock is ticking, and we have to find a solution for this illegal tariffs, and we really are requesting the withdrawal of these tariffs. And we have some other conflicts as well. So I guess it's now the time to solve these issues. And Guntram, lastly, you mentioned Catherine Tai's speech on China mainly, and it was not such a big innovation. And this, I guess, has a background, and this is my experience in Washington in end of July as well. The most important criteria for U.S. trade policy is the domestic situation. And this is also valid for the steel tariffs regarding China. How trade policy is received domestically, politically, or economically, that's the criteria. And therefore, I'm a little bit reluctant that we can really find a common approach in a lot of issues globally.
Yeah, if I can say so, quite a sober assessment of the ambition that could come out of Washington on its global relations. A lot of domestic constraints driving the U.S. policies at this stage. So is there any sort of bright side on the U.S. trade policy where you see really an optimism and scope for EU-U.S. cooperation? I mean, you mentioned that U.S.-EU Trade and Technology Council. Is that perhaps an avenue where you see big successes? Because we do share some concerns on the competition policies and innovation policies and the big tech companies. So is that an avenue where you see more cooperation scope?
As I mentioned, it's a platform to have a continuous dialogue in several areas. So we established 10 working groups. And of course, there might be some cooperation possible. For example, regarding investment screening, we have different system on both sides of the Atlantic. Perhaps we can cooperate, exchange of views and data and so on. And also regarding the question of subsidies from third country companies being on the internal market, the US side is quite interesting to look on the European proposal. And on new technologies like artificial intelligence, there might be also some standards which we could establish by both sides. So we are looking now really on the low-hanging fruits of our cooperation, having in mind that a comprehensive trade agreement, as we tried to do it with TTIP, is not possible. That's totally clear. So this Trade and Technology Council is not TTIP 2.0. It is just a platform to exchange. And therefore, it shouldn't overestimate the avenue of the solutions, just focusing on some low-hanging fruits, reachables in a reasonable time frame as well. So this is the goal of this exercise. And I guess this is positive element as it is, not more.
So I do want to bring in also Alicia, who's looking at this at the moment, I think, from Taipei. And Alicia, where do you see the US-EU trade relation? And, you know, what do you think should be next also when it comes to China?
Well, I think Ambassador Tsai's speech Monday night, or at least Monday morning in the US, my night, was very telling as regards two things. First, there's no way the US is going to stop biting, if I may use that expression. It's still there, biting with these tariffs. Even if I think there's a recognition that these tariffs aren't the way to go, but I guess in the lack of other things to bite, I not being sure about what to do next, you just keep on doing. I think in a way it shows that they need, quote unquote, even more time to find a strategy on China. They just don't have it yet. And I think one thing they tried, the Biden administration, was really this digital trade pact, which is a little bit of a similar thing, Asia digital trade pact. So I think tech and digital have been at the forefront of that embryonic new trade agenda for Biden. But in the same way as Bernard was saying, well, it's just, you know, don't take it as a major issue. Here in Asia, everybody thought, okay, if that's all you have to offer, you know, we may as well keep on trading with China because this is too little and it's too biased. It's too good for the US, it doesn't bring anything to us. In a nutshell, I think the US has been overestimating its ability to gather support, whether in Europe or in Asia, at very little cost. It's not happening because, again, there are other options. The Chinese economy is simply too big to ignore, and people know this. And I think you need to put more on the balance to be considered as a relevant partner. Because they can't put anything else in the balance, exactly for the reasons you both mentioned, domestic reasons. This is really Faustian. Since you're both German, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. you give up on something you know is good because you have to, because you have an agenda that is just too important, and you need that bipartisan consensus. That's China, that's trade, that's it. You offer, you know, tiny bits here and there to see whether it works. It doesn't work, you keep on going. Yeah, you keep, again, biting with these tariffs. That's all you can do. Mm-hmm. In other words, and I finish there, it looks a little bit as the Biden administration is trapped on trade. I don't think it's even a strategy. It's just trapped on the inability to have a strategy.
Any reactions on that?
Yeah, to some degree, I would underline this. I know that inside the White House, they are discussing on trade strategy, and they are really trying to combine trade policy with foreign and security policy. There is a group trying to coordinate, but I guess it's not totally developed, this strategy, and a clear message that there is no common strategy is, of course, the question of this AUKUS deal, the submarine deal with Australia, where, of course, the trust in our partnership was a little bit damaged. And I guess, they are working on a common strategy, and the recognition that perhaps for some of their targets, Europe as a partner on an equal footing is needed. This is not always recognized in the White House, I guess.
Yes, indeed. And perhaps before we move to China more specifically, let me ask one last question on the WTO, and you know whether that couldn't be an avenue for the US and the EU to agree a bit more on the way forward, because in principle, the multilateral system is what we as Europeans champion. And in principle, we also know that, I mean, now with the upcoming ministerial conference, it has become really important for the WTO to have a success. And, you know, if that success doesn't materialize very soon at this ministerial conference, I mean, the organization might become completely irrelevant. So if there is still a will to sort of salvage the multilateral trading system, arguably this is an avenue where Europe and the US could cooperate, and where also the US might face less domestic pressure at this stage than in general revising its bilateral policies and removing tariffs on China or on the EU. So why is there not more happening on the multilateral front?
Yeah, that is a serious problem. I'm a little bit nervous at the moment about the World Trade Organization. We as European, you are quite right, we have a strong interest in this multilateral rules-based system with 164 partner countries. We have a really diversified trade relation to a lot of countries worldwide, export and also import. 60% of our import are going to the export of our products and services. So we are really deeply involved in international trade, and we need a rules-based system. And we need also modernization, no doubt about. All the rules are from 1994 and even older, and we need modernization. And of course, a crucial partner in this game are the United States. And there is a lack of engagement, really, really. In principle, they are in favor, but really concrete to the negotiations going on, we are negotiating now, there's not really a tough engagement. We are discussing trade and health. So there are some general remarks, but really no concrete proposal by the United States. And of course, we have the serious problem that the dispute settlement mechanism, the second stage, the appellate body, is blocked by the United States in nominating judges for this appellate body. So there is no really functioning dispute settlement. And by the way, this was a crown jewel of the whole exercise, recognized by all the member states. So we need some success in the ministerial conference in late November, December. Otherwise, this organization is in real danger. And there is an upcoming discussion in Europe, but also quite strong in the United States to build an additional or new instrument from like-minded countries. And I guess this would lead to a bloc building against China. And this is not in our interest. But look, the United States has not appointed now ambassador to the WTO in Geneva. So this is a slight indication of their engagement. So we are trying to push them to find some common goals for MC12. But at the moment, it's really critical.
So it's not in our interest that there's bloc building against China. I think that's a very important statement. Alicia, perhaps you want to kick us off on the EU-China considerations.
Put it this way, I think it's not in our interest to create a bloc on China, but it's also not in our interest in a way for the world to not to have a strategy on China. I mean, it's neither of the two, which makes it very complex, yeah, because if we end up in a world without WTO, as we hear, or you know, a very kind of a lame duck, basically the status quo, if we can't solve that, and you have two great powers looking inward, and there's increasing evidence on China as well, in as far as there is more and more substitution on imports, this is dual circulation, self-reliance, etc., you will end up having a region in the world, and this is Europe, which is very dependent on external demand, suffering the most in a nutshell. Maybe South Korea, maybe Japan as well. I mean, this would be the three major blocks which would suffer. So in a way, what I'm trying to say here is that it's not only about alignment with China, or, you know, avoiding a bloc with China. It's even more complex. This is, as Bernd said, keeping those conditions by which there is multilateral, that any middle power can have a say. Otherwise, it is still a problem, even if we do not align with the US to block China. I don't know which of the two are bigger as a problem, but I know that both are a problem. So in a way, the complexity here for me, as regards China and the EU's trade policy, is that it's a minefield. We need to avoid too many things. It's not that we only need to avoid one thing. That makes it extremely difficult. And what we know we should be pushing for, which is multilateralism, is not in our hands, to be very frank. It's not only in our hands. So we keep on moving with all of these minefields. And the target, which is WTO reform, is further and further away. So that's why we may end up in one, I eventually aligning with the US, or the other. And that would mean that middle power, I don't mean to say that Europe is a middle power, because we're a major power economically, but we aren't politically. And that's what matters in the current geopolitical juncture. Thus, any of the two is probably as bad. I wouldn't be able to choose which minefield to fall on, to be frank.
So Bernd, what's your take?
Yeah, the question of the China strategy is one of important, and you're quite right saying that there's a difference between our economic power and the political power, and this is linked to the constitution in the European Union, so that foreign policy is based on unanimity inside the Council, and the member states have really different interests and also different relations to China, so it's really complicated to have a common strategy and view on China. And this is an ongoing discussion inside the Council. But nevertheless, we have different levels where we have to deal with China. And I guess the multilateral level isn't important. So we have to do our utmost to have China in the tent of WTO, but also in other multilateral negotiations like the climate change issue. Without China, there will be no solution for climate change and in some other international issues as well. So we need to deal with China in this global multilateral cooperation. Then, of course, we have also some bilateral issues with China. The question of economic relations, the investment agreement, which is now in the freeze, but in principle, it's quite right to have a kind of equivalence in our trade and investment relation. And then, of course, we have some unilateral measures which are defending our political and economic interests. We are discussing the International Procurement Initiative so that we have a clear message to everybody that we are open our procurement market only to countries where we have equivalent openness also in their procurement market. We are dealing now with subsidies of companies present in the European internal market. We will have the question of due diligence in supply chains coming up. We will have a new anti-coercion instrument in place quite soon so that we are able to defend our interest against trading partners worldwide. So the three levels we should have in mind to stick to our, as we call it now, to our strategic autonomy, not to be too dependent on China, but on the other side, have also possibilities to cooperate where necessary.
So these were a lot of points. I mean, so we have the defensive instruments, and obviously we have also the instruments trying to deepen economic relations. And there you mentioned the EU-China investment agreement that is currently in a freezer. Do you want to say one or two words what it would take to get it out of the freezer?
Yeah, of course. This is really depending on the political situation. So as you know, China take some sanctions against some colleagues of mine and some officials inside the European Union as well. This is, of course, not acceptable. And I hope that we can really convince the Chinese government to lift the sanctions and come back to, let's say, status quo of diplomatic relations. And secondly, Gundam, we have the French elections in May next year. And probably at the end of next year, we can perhaps open the freeze and take this investment agreement out. I guess it has a basis for stabilizing the investment relations and give more legal security, and gives also some hints regarding trade-related aspects like labor rights and environmental standards. I guess the European Parliament will look for the implementation and monitoring of these obligations. But this, I guess, will take a long time.
Yes, so you're already mentioning, and Alicia, I'm looking at you if you want to react on any specific China point, but you already mentioned, of course, human rights and environmental issues. But Alicia, do you want to react on anything on China
Yes.
specifically?
I think I want to react on Kai, because I fear that by the time these sanctions may be lifted, which frankly speaking, might be in our hands because we have our own sanctions. So, you know, I guess China is just waiting for us to lift those. And then, so in other words, I don't think that's so difficult. It's a question whether we want to do so and say we need to wait for the French elections. Fine. One could also argue that maybe Macron wants to be the one, you know, like pushing this. It depends on exactly the point I want to make. Sentiment on China and Europe, yeah? And my sense is that the more we wait, the worse it will get. It will be increasingly difficult for any European government, this could be the case of Germany as well, to make the point that this was a good idea. Whether it is or not is not the argument I'm trying to make here. It's just how hard it will be. On top of that, China has other options. I mean, it's kind of work hard on a language that, frankly speaking, I think leaves quite a lot of flexibility for China on labor rights and beyond. A lot of leeway. We know that, you know, it's hard to negotiate with China. And I still think that, you know, I commend the negotiators on our side. But the reality is that China could go very easily with what it has on that CAI to the CPTPP. And just say, look, this is what I have. Here you go. I have something on SOEs. I have some transparency on subsidies. You know, here it is. This is my offer. And China could basically, quote unquote, forget or you know, in a way, not pay so much attention, in other words, to ROCAI compared to a much broader market access, because at the end of the day, CPTPP is indeed a trade deal. to say, look, you made me wait too long. So
yeah,
I'm just saying that this is a dynamic thing. And this is very European. Things can be frozen. To be very frank, this is not a criticism to having frozen that decision, because I can fully understand that, you know, why it was done. But I'm just saying that from the perspective of somebody sitting in Asia where things move fast, yeah, China has already applied. By the way, with, you know, 2 days later, Taiwan applying, who was going to apply first? Who knows? Because, you know, just think about, you know, one possibility that China was just reacting, and this, in a way, Taiwan's intention is speed it up. China's intention, we will never know. But the point is, it goes fast. And this is something we need to realize in the light of things. Yeah, it's quite important to know what is our Asia strategy. I mean, that was for me the point. More generally, it can't be Kai only. It's just too small. China is not small, but the purpose of Kai is small. So I think we need to kind of open our mind and say, okay, what do we want to do in Asia? Frankly speaking, and benefiting from the reluctance from the Biden administration to do so, because it gives us a first mover advantage. I mean, we should be thinking loud and clear, what do we want to do in Asia now?
So should we join CPTPP?
For example?
Bernd, what do you think?
No, that is not the style of trade agreement we would like to see. It's just trying to merge existing trade agreements. I guess we have 2,000 pages of additional obligations so that these existing trade agreements could merge. And there are no requirements regarding labor rights or environmental standards at all. So this is not the style of a trade agreement we would like to see. And secondly, of course, this is, of course, also going in the direction of block building. And I have no clue how now the request for being member of this agreement will be decided on. We are, of course, negotiating with a lot of countries involved in this trade agreement, bilateral with Indonesia, with Malaysia, and Indonesia. We are making quite significant success. We are dealing with Australia and New Zealand as well. So we have, let's say, our own responsibility in the Asia region. And you're quite right that sometimes European Union is a little bit slow, and the development is going quite fast. But we have a different approach. And I guess the trade agreement with Vietnam is a good example to have a clear vision of an economic relation and benefiting to the people on the ground, but also looking for proper implementation and monitoring system, and give Vietnam also a little bit more independence from their big neighbor. So it's a little bit different than just merging traditional, just based on tariff reduction, the trade agreements.
Perhaps we want to conclude our conversation by discussing how far trade policy can and should be used for other purposes rather than trade. I mean, the European Parliament, of course, has been very vocal and championing, including many other values and interests into trade agreements, starting from environmental protection to labor rights, human rights, but also, of course, increasingly there's a strong debate on, you know, can we use trade policy to accelerate climate action across the world? And the EU has made very strong points about a carbon border adjustment mechanism. So Bernd, I want to get a feeling from you on where you see this debate. How far can the EU go? How much leverage do we really have? How much do we lose out also when we insist too much on all of these other points on growth opportunities in a world, as Alicia describes it, where many players are very far, including Asian players? So where do you see this overall balance? I mean, of course, we cannot agree on trade agreements when there is blatant, say, misuse or blatant violations of human rights, for example. I mean, I see that point, but there's also, of course, the other side of the argument. And so where's the parliament on this? And where do you think should the European Union be on this?
It's an important question, Tom. And I think, first of all, it's totally clear that, for example, labor rights are linked to trade questions, because with a dumping situation on labor rights, there is a competition advantage, and this is not acceptable. But this is also valid for environmental standards and for climate change as well. So on climate change, as you mentioned, we are discussing now a new system to have a clear possibility to force climate action on both sides, domestically and for foreign companies as well. So this carbon border adjustment mechanism, I will come back to this a bit later. But this link between trade and labor rights, environmental trend, is obvious. Even the European Court of Justice mentioned this in ruling on agreement we concluded with Singapore, the Singapore Trade Agreement. And in this ruling, the European Court of Justice made totally clear that labor standards and environment standards are integral parts of a trade agreement. But secondly, we have to be crystal clear that we want not to transform or transport our European values to other countries. I had a discussion with some colleagues from Congo recently, saying, oh, after the old colonial imperialism, now you are coming with the social imperialism view on the thing, and this is harming our developing possibilities. So this is not the case. We are really sticking to universal agreed standards. So the core ILO of the International Labour Organization conventions, the UN Environmental Conventions, and the Paris Climate Agreement, more or less all countries of the world have signed these conventions, and trade is a powerful tool, yes, and we should use trade to implement this universal accepted standards. And this should be the task, and not trying to export the European model. And on climate change, yes, we are a little bit the forerunner of the game, and we would like to see other countries going in the same direction. And this could be reached not only with bilateral trade agreement, but also in forcing importers to use the same level of climate protection as we do it domestically. But of course, we have to use this instrument quite carefully so that we are not going in the direction of a protective system. We want to really motivate other countries going the same path on climate change as we did do. So we have really, I guess, also to, let's say, improve the proposal by the European Commission to avoid trade wars and trade escalations with the United States, but also with developing countries, so that this instrument is really an instrument which help the climate change fighting.
Perhaps a couple of minutes on this carbon border adjustment mechanism and on what it can achieve. So let's spend the last few minutes on the carbon border adjustment mechanism. And you mentioned that the Commission proposals might have to be improved. So I would, of course, be curious to hear what you have in mind exactly on that point. More broadly, I do think a carbon border adjustment mechanism is actually WTO compatible and can be done really in a way that ensures a level playing field between foreign producers and domestic producers. So in principle, I'm actually quite favorable to the carbon border adjustment idea. But I do know that a lot of people around the world, especially in the developing countries, see this really, as you also mentioned, as more as a protectionist measure. and even argue that it's against the spirit of the Paris Agreement because it undermines the national commitments that have been agreed on climate change and forces countries to accelerate climate action. So if you can just walk us a little bit more through this, tension, protectionism versus level playing field, but also more specifically, how you see the Commission's proposal and where do you think improvement is necessary?
Yes, so the main problem I see is that the criteria for the carbon border adjustment mechanism is the CO2 price in Europe. And this should lead to some extra tariffs for imported goods. And now looking to developed countries like the United States or other like-minded countries like Japan, they have no CO2 price. And I guess in the United States, there will be no CO2 price. Even I guess at the moment, they have 4 proposals in the Congress, but there will be no majority for such a CO2 price. Nevertheless, the Biden administration is putting a lot of money in technology development. So we need to have equivalence mechanism to recognize equivalence measures against climate change to our CO2 price. This is not an easy task, but I guess it's reachable. So there's the idea of creating a climate club, so where will be no carbon border adjustment mechanism. Jennifer Hillman, I like her very much, makes a proposal of a climate custom union, so that is no additional tariffs on climate change if there is an equivalence between developed countries. So this is one task, Guntram, and the other is regarding the developing countries. Yeah, in the proposal of the Commission, we have at the moment 5 sectors where this CBAM should happen. So steel, aluminium, and cement. And looking to the import of cement to the European Union, the main importers are Morocco and Tunisia. And if you are now using the European CO2 price on cement coming from these 2 countries, the economic situation will be a disaster because there will be no import anymore. And I guess this should be also not in our interest, also not politically in the interest regarding to harm further the economic situation, specifically in Tunisia. And as you mentioned, the obligation on the Paris Climate Agreement for the developing countries are different to the European ones. And there is a rationality behind. Still, we are emitting per person more than the emissions from Tunisia are. So we have to really adjust the mechanism towards developing countries. But in principle, I'm totally agreeing. This is a valid measure, and I was always in favor of that, if it's WTO compatible and if it's really respecting equivalence measures and respecting the interests of the developing world.
Okay, this is a wonderful concluding statement. And of course, the climate club issue has been very dear also to discussions here at Bruegel. I mean, we've had a piece earlier this year in the scientific journal Nature, in which we were actually arguing for a climate club between the US, Europe, and possibly even China to accelerate global climate action. But as you say, I mean, the devil is in the detail. And there are, of course, issues for some developing countries where this will be immediately irrelevant. Even though I have to say, I mean, of course, part of the idea is that you reduce dirty cement imports from Tunisia or elsewhere. I mean, that's part of the idea of the carbon border adjustment. Now, you might want to be careful with introducing it, but in principle, that's...
Yeah, but then, for example, you could use the revenue of the CBAM for a project in Tunisia and Morocco and not it to the budget of the European Union.
No, with this, I totally agree. And I think one should not see the CBAM primarily as a tax revenue for the EU budget. I mean, that would be a big mistake. Absolutely. I fully agree. Well, I think that's all the time we have for today. Bernd Lange, thank you so much for joining us on Bruegel's podcast. And Alicia, of course, thank you also for being here and inspiring us with your views. Thank you so much. And until next time, bye-bye.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much.